You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, Yoel here again for another episode of Tzohar LaMikra. And this week we're continuing on the lines of, I would jokingly call it, Who Stole My Bible? Where I'm going to be tackling some of the elements that people use to argue that things from the Tanakh were stolen, as people claim. Obviously, this claim is very incorrect and is considered to be incorrect by many scholars. Ones who claim that it is correct are usually people who are anyhow out there to attack the Bible. But as I've said before, the study here, the way Genesis is actually studied, because this subject really mostly only connects to the subject of Genesis, especially the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and from that point on, discussion slightly weakens. Though I've seen people try to claim other things about other parts of the Bible, but those ones are less important and less of an issue, and in most cases, you really have to squeeze things out forcefully. Instead of basically saying, these are natural features of the ancient Near East, and people would use the same symbols the same way today. If I want to talk about something in Torah and to put it in our terminology, I would use something from our time. So really, when people argue on this, it's mostly very superficial understanding, very stubborn way of understanding the text. However, we do need to realize that there are some questions, as I pointed out last time, and so on. So this requires, again, a sensitivity to types of material, the difference between different things of material, and also remembering that many of these stories are connected to things which were either known in the ancient world, something which was pan-human, all human beings were involved in this in some way or another, and that things were also written with a specific style. Like, for example, there's a certain way of telling a story, a certain motif that's used over and over again. And this motif doesn't say it doesn't happen, because certain motifs on a literature level, motifs are chosen based on things which do happen in reality. It's a new genre today that people write fantasy stories, but even in fantasy stories, we still use elements from our world. You take, for example, Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is considered to be a metaphor for many things, but it also takes ideas from our world. You know, the concept of a messiah, which fits into the character of whatever his name was, the descendant of Isildur, the Aragorn, and so on. And you have, who's called Strider, if I'm not mistaken, before he's exposed to who he really is. And you have elements of an ultimate ancient evil, which resembles the idea of the devil. But when Tolkien wrote his book, it was also a massive commentary on the industrial world he lives in. So for him, Mordor was really the factories which are producing all the smoke and the destruction of the classic world and so on. So there's always something, even in fantasy stories. And I chose Tolkien deliberately because I've been working on, I helped a friend out with writing a paper, actually something to finish the degree in English literature, and we were having discussions about this book, and I was exposed to a lot of interesting points that they were researching. And even fantasy stories still borrow things from our actual world. So it's not really exactly the same, but the idea itself, the way the human beings create stories is quite standard. People do very similar things throughout the centuries. So you need to have a sensitivity of understanding how to transmission information to people, what are the mechanisms they're used. This way, Bible scholars are not really just Bible scholars. The Bible scholars deal a lot with literature, with the concept of literature, with language, with culture. I mean, being a Bible scholar is being very eclectic. You have to collect information from a lot of different places. So it doesn't really end just with knowing the Bible. To say you're a Bible scholar, you need to know a lot of fields. But in any case, going to the character of Noah. So Noah is presented as this perfect human being. So this is really difference number one. Who is Noah? So in some of the Babylonian stories, like for example, the story of Tahasis, or the story of Otnapishtim, depends who you ask, they're not presented as moral characters. This is one of the major differences. The story here is a moral story. The story here connects to human behavior, human nature, and not divine nature, not the nature of the gods. So who is Noah? So the first verse here, which is chapter 6, verse 9, obviously the man who divided up the Bible into chapters 1,000 years ago had no knowledge whatsoever of how to actually divide these things up. A lot of the division was it seems to be very arbitrary or based on theological needs. So it says, Ele toldot Noah, this is the toldot, the history of Noah. Noah ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav. Noah was a righteous, a complete righteous man in his generations. Okay, because people lived a very long time, so they saw several generations. And then it says another definition, et ha'elohim hitalech Noah. Noah walked with God. Now, usually when you say with, the preposition uses im. However, here, there's an interesting element here that he's not really physically walking with God. He was walking mentally with the footsteps of God. So this is why it's preferred to use the word et instead of the word im. At least that's the way I understand it. So he's not walking literally with God. He's walking in the footsteps of God or in the mentality that God expects from man. So Noah is presented here from two aspects. He's a tzaddik tamim. And tzaddik also comes from the word tzaddik. So a person who is tzaddik, in many cases, can be understood as a person who is morally well-behaved, and not necessarily something to do with the divine. Noah is presented here basically from the two aspects of mankind. On the one hand, he's a tzaddik tamim. He's a righteous man in the sense of his human relations with other people. He's a moral person. He's also tamim, which means complete. So he is, and this is the relation to the concept of dorotav, he is not necessarily done in comparison to his generations, as some classic commentaries try to claim, which I think is a reasonable claim. Rashi, for example, says he was in his generations in the sense of his timeline, but it also can say that he was righteous towards the people of his generations, that anyone who came in contact with him was treated well, that it was a moral standard that he followed. And then it also says that he walked with God. This is the other aspect of a righteous man, that he's not only righteous towards other people, but he's also righteous towards God. Now, what's interesting here is the fact that, first of all, the righteousness towards men comes first, and only afterwards the righteousness towards man, which is really the whole idea of this parasha, this entire section in the Torah. It's a discussion of the corruption of man mostly between people, which brings us to the question, so what is the chamas? What is the chamas which is mentioned in this story? Because it says, "V'timaleh ha'aretz chamas," and therefore the land was full of chamas, and therefore God became sorry. There's an interesting idea here, by the way, about God being repenting or regretting creating man. And there's a whole discussion, is God presented here in a metaphorical? And is this anthropomorphic, or is this literally God also has emotions, and we don't really have a way of answering this? So I'm just going to go with the lines of we're describing God through human terms, but not necessarily saying what really went on with God. But what's interesting here is, what is this chamas? So if we say that the emphasis here is the moral behavior between human beings, chamas must be something which people are doing to one another. A statistic check of the appearance of the word Hamas seems to be more to do with violence, murder, something in that area. So the main issue was not idol worshiping, that comes later. The issue was that mankind basically mistreated one another. So this is also a very, very important point to all mankind. We need to learn to keep the balance between being kind to one another and also obeying God. So I don't necessarily agree with people who, for example, go out and they're chastising everyone because presumably they're not keeping the commandments correctly. But then these people, they say they're so righteous before God and they think they're holier than thou. But on the other hand, they're basically nasty people. So if you have difficulty having a reasonable relationship with another human being, how do you expect to have a reasonable relationship with God? What makes you think that that's how it narrows down? You have to guard it, and you think you're on with this righteous tantrum of claiming that you're doing what God says, and on the other hand, you're being nasty to everyone else. I don't think you gain anything out of that. I think that obviously there are situations, we have plenty of situations in the Bible where people had to put their foot down and also be violent, but I think those are very specific situations. Those are situations where something very abominable is going on in the world, and not necessarily just, you know, people are just not keeping Torah. I think there is some kind of a subtle difference there. But also remember, Elijah was taken away. And there's an explanation that says one of the reasons Elijah was taken away is because he was too violent for his time. He was too aggressive. His approach to everyone else was too aggressive. And God said, I can't let you function. They're not going to listen to a person like you. But you're so righteous, I can't kill you. Also, where did Elijah go to? Which is all the question of where did Enoch go to? Just a quick word about Enoch. Enoch, it really means that he died. He wasn't really wished up into heaven. It's a much, much latter explanation during the Second Temple that he went up to heaven. And then the whole story of Enoch came in, which, by the way, leads us into another subject in this parasha, which we'll talk about in a moment, which is the calendar issue. Okay, so he's commanded to build an ark and so on. So there are several things here about the story of Noah which are very similar to things we find in the ancient Near East, such as the usage of 10 generations. We find that with 10 generations from one, each stage to the other, if you pick up the story of Artaxerxes or something like that, it's a different name. But something in the area of Artaxerxes. But in any case, all these strange Sumerian names are very difficult to pronounce sometimes. But in any case, what's most important here is that there's the usage of 10 generations. But this is a mechanism of literature. It's not a mechanism of copying from one another. Then there is a deity who tells man that there's going to be a flood, but there's a massive difference because in the story, the Sumerian story, and then the latter Babylonian development, it's not the major god that, first of all, there are many gods in the Sumerian pantheon and the Babylonian pantheon, but one of the differences is here, in the story of Noah, he is told directly by God who is the one who brings the flood, which shows that the action of saving Noah is an action of mercy also from the same, I'll call it character, quote unquote, that also brings the flood. So we're seeing the two sides of God, the need to punish, but also the side of mercy. In the story of the Sumerian flood story, it is another god who it's not the gods who bring the flood, it's some other god who rebels against the other gods and tells a very specific individual a flood's going to come. So that's another difference. There are, in both stories, there are descriptions of how to build an ark. I think, again, this is a mechanical thing. This is not enough to prove that someone was stealing from one another. There is a description of what to take into the ark. Again, pan-human story, which means that the elements are still this is all human beings were involved in the story, and therefore the similarities doesn't mean someone stole. It's the same story, just being told in a different way. The main point here are the differences mostly from the theological point of view. We have the whole idea of the detailed description of destruction of mankind. Again, still part of the major story. We have landing on a side of a mountain. Again, part of the major story, sending a bird, building an altar. But for example, in the building of the altar, in the Sumerian stories, the gods spun around the sacrifices like flies. And this is a major difference because it says that God smelled the sacrifice and was appeased. There's a very strong difference from a monotheistic point of view. The story is told very differently. The perspective of who God is very, very different. The gods, also the thing is that the gods in the Sumerian story sent the flood because mankind made noise. It was a very selfish thing, a very selfish act from the side of the gods, and it had nothing to do with mankind misbehaving and mistreating one another. It had to do with man made noise, the gods were just violent and nasty and attacked us and killed everyone, except for this one man who survived. But there's also the element of, you know, what was the point of the sacrifice? The sacrifice wasn't there to feed God. It was there to show appeasing. There's a massive difference here in how the divine is presented. Now, there are actually some very massive differences. First of all, the idea of the type of animals which are taken in. So we have the 7 versus the 2. I'm not going to go there because that's it's a very, very interesting subject, but I'm not going to go there at this time. I will say that obviously that the text is showing a difference between clean animals and unclean animals. But the fact that there's a discussion about clean and unclean shows that there's again a very strong theological side here connected to the Torah. Now, a lot of people use this whole thing of clean and unclean to argue that the times of Noah, they knew about Torah, they knew clean and unclean. But again, remember, this text is being read out to people living a very, very long time later. I mean, even if we say that these stories were played around with, these stories were known to people, and the Israelites had traditions as well. Notice the fact that if an Israelite had this story, if they had the general version of mankind, they wouldn't have this version. This version already presents the story a little differently and also uses terminology. The concept of tameh and tahor, or behema shel, and tehora v'she'enena tehora, the clean and the one which is not clean, does not necessarily mean that no one knew the difference between clean and unclean. What it shows is that when the story was written, we now can use the terminology that we have now to describe what they had back then. But it doesn't mean that Noah actually received the words of clean and unclean. It doesn't necessarily mean that he did. It's also quite possible that at this time, Noah was still in the vegetarian stage of mankind, which means that there was no element of clean and unclean because they anyhow didn't consume the animals. Okay? So that's one thing. But also the way God is described again. I mean, there are differences here. Most of them are on the theological monotheistic level, where God is described as having full control of the flood. He is the one who brings the flood and he is the one who takes away the flood. Okay, so there's full control. While in the Sumerian story, it seems to be that they basically, the flood came and it rampaged all over the place. Here, God has control, which also has to do with the control of God over the ark itself. In the Sumerian story, there's a sailor who helps navigate this boat or this ship that they had. Here, God is the one navigating the boat, which means he also had control over the waters. So it's very, very different. The morality side, God expects mankind to be moral instead of the whole idea of the gods destroying mankind for being noisy. There are also issues here that have to do with the covenant that's made with Noah. It's not that, oh, we destroyed it, you survived, okay, whatever. There's a control element here. God has absolute control over everything, which stands in opposition to, for example, the stories of Tiamat and Epsu, the chaotic waters and so on. So Noah also makes a covenant with God, and this covenant is a covenant that's there to protect all of mankind, promising this will never happen again, showing the mercy of God, showing the control of God, showing all these elements that God is the one in control of everything, but God is also a moral God. He will not bring destruction for no reason. So there is a difference. There is a fine point difference here between the Sumerian stories, but still, we're still working on stories that existed, that affected all of mankind. And therefore, claiming that someone stole something is obviously ridiculous. If I tell a story of World War II, so can he claim that I've stolen a story because I gave a specific perspective? For example, telling the story of the Second World War from the perspective of the Holocaust, or telling the story from the perspective of people who lived in France, or people who live in North Africa? It doesn't matter. We're talking about all mankind being involved in this story. So that's another point. Now, I do want to bring up this whole thing about people claiming that there's no evidence of a flood. Besides the fact that there is evidence of water covering massive parts of the world, we also have to remember that the story is talking about the masses of land that mankind lived on. So there is a question here, did it cover everything, or did it cover everything of the known world they lived in? It's just a thought, something to chew on. Okay, now we have, dealing with the actual text itself, we have the subject of the calendar. And I've had a lot of people contact me about the dates and so on. And what it seems to be, first of all, we have a structure here of seven. We have 7 days of actual rain, or 7 days waiting, and so on. And then we have 40 days of rain, okay? But then when we look at the flood itself, we also have actual specific dates. So the specific dates come out as being 30 days for each month. Now, what exactly is the question here? The question isn't really about the 7 days and the 40 days and so on. Because really what we have here is, it says the flood will be 40 days and 40 nights. So there's a side of the story that seems to be that after 40 days and 40 nights, the flood is over. But then we have a description of 150 days, which is 5 months. And during those 5 months, there's still water covering the entire earth. So there are scholars who claim that we have two different variants of the story side by side. So that opens up people claiming that there really is an E source versus a P source, and the priestly source, P stands for priestly. The priestly source says that there was really a flood for 150 days. It wasn't 40 days. It didn't go according to the conventions of 7 and 40 and so on. But even if that is true, you can still look at the story as being one gigantic story where there was a process. There was 7 days of waiting and then 40 days of the actual rain, and then another 110 days or another 150 days of the actual flood itself, where everything was covered with water. I don't really see a problem here. I think the writers themselves, even if they had two different sources in front of them, understood that there's really no contradiction here, because the concept of contradiction in our world, we look for fine points these days, and we sometimes look at some discussions between people and they catch one another on these tiny little pointers. But that actually has to do with rhetoric. That has to do with a Greek development from around the fourth century, fifth and fourth centuries, when the demagogues, the leaders who led according to speech and not actually doing something, which is very similar to our politics today. And the creation of politeia, which means the collective of people, which then in time became politics, which is the feature of democracy. But today, back then, people weren't too concerned with the fine details. So they didn't really see these as contradictions. That's number one. But I ignore the whole P and E and so on, because the idea of the sources doesn't answer all the questions. People are very big on the document hypothesis, and they don't really know that there are, the 30 years after the document hypothesis came out, Wilhausen's students themselves questioned their teacher's methods and found problems with everything that he said. So they developed other theories and so on. So this is stuff that most people don't get to learn. But the whole idea of the 30 days. So it seems to be that having a period of 5 months where each month is exactly 30 days influenced certain people in the Second Temple and even today to claim that the calendar is really built from 12 months of 30 days each. And during the Second Temple period, we had people who claimed to such a calendar and had these complex calendars. For example, the calendar of Qumran, where each month is literally 30 days, but a year is not really exactly 30 days. Even the Roman calendar, which is completely solar, has to have days which are 31, months which are 31, and months which are 30, and then you have February, it's 28, and then every 4 years it's 29, and so on, to balance things out. So it's very difficult to even accept this claim of having exactly 30 days. So the question is asked, so why do we actually have this description of having 30 days for each month? And I think the answer lies in the idea of the disruption of nature. Because what we have in the promise of God to Noah, actually God speaks to himself, but this is really a promise to Noah, that there will no longer, summer and winter will never be confused. It says, Kites of a Holif. And because of what happened, everything in nature kind of went out of whack. But to keep time, because they might actually not be able to actually see the moon or see the cycles of any sort, And obviously winter and summer and spring, everything was mixed up together. Though it seems to be the most of the rain and everything came down during what was more like spring, summertime. The approach was to take the maximum amount of time for a month. So a month, a lunar cycle is 29.5 and a whole bunch of other digits after it, which makes a month either being 29 days or 30 days. Okay, this is why sometimes when you go to the moon sighting, sometimes at the end of 29 days, you can't see anything because it depends on how much exposure of the moon's surface how much of the surface of the moon is exposed to the sun with Earth blocking the sun from the moon. And also how much time do you have from sunset to the setting of the moon? You have to at least 40 minutes. And, you know, I've done some very difficult sightings and they were not easy to sight, but I was able to see them. And so on. But then you have many cases where you go out on 29th day and there's nothing, you can't see anything. The moon is there. I mean, it's physically there, but you actually have to physically see it as well. So because of this problem, you can't just arbitrarily say, oh, it was 29 days. One can argue that they prefer to take 30 days, take the maximum amount of time and put that in instead of claiming that, that it was 29 days. Because again, even if we say that the account here is passed down accurately from the times of Noah, okay? Or if we claim that the story was passed down and there might have been some mistakes along the line, we still have an issue here of dating how long things were. So the most simple and, by the way, easiest thing to track are the whole round numbers. So a month anyhow can be 30 days as well, and it happens quite frequently. And also because you can't go out and sight the moon and see how much time passes, the simplest thing to do is to keep track of round numbers. And 150 days is easier than to start counting, say, if there were 29 days, but there might have been 30 days here and 29 over there and so on. You might have somewhere in between 145 to 150 days. The Bible prefers in many situations to use clean round numbers. 480 years from the Exodus when King Solomon built the temple. 400 years of servitude in Egypt, and so on. Every round numbers are easier to deal with, especially when you're trying to give approximated dates. It's easier to say, oh, it was about 20 or 30, instead of saying, oh, yeah, it was exactly 34 point whatever. It's round numbers and complete numbers have a much easier to deal with, because really one may argue that it's not really that relevant exactly how long it was. However, I have met people who argue that there's a special meaning to each number that's used. And there was a big debate in medieval times between different rabbis regarding is there a secret meaning or some special meaning to the numbers being used and so on. Some claimed there was, some claimed there wasn't. Maimonides, for example, stood on the side of, no, this is just recording the exact numbers of what was going on. And it doesn't really have any secretive meaning. And I'm more for that, to saying that there's no secretive meaning instead of trying to speculate and invent things. Okay, last subject we have here this week is what happened with Canaan and why was Canaan cursed? Or what happened with Ham? And why was Canaan specifically cursed? Okay, so first of all, a very common interpretation that's been promoted throughout because of recordings made by certain individuals is that Ham raped his father. Now, first of all, that's very, very speculative. However, it does appear in some very, very old sources. But we need to understand some of the logic of how children-parent relationships worked. Stripping someone of their clothing is a massive insult. It used to be that when you took prisoners and you wanted to humiliate them to the maximum, you strip them completely from their clothing, you tie them together, and you make them march so everyone can see them naked. Okay? So for a child to see his parent naked was something which is considered to be an abomination, something which is considered to be a very high insult towards the parent. And even in Judaism to this very day, a child is not allowed, a son and a father are not allowed to go into a washroom together if it's going to be that the father and the child are going to see each other naked, especially if the child sees the parent naked. So we need to understand that though the idea of the hisol, it says vayesht min hayayin vayishkar, he drank from the wine and became drunk, veidgal betoch aholo, and he exposed himself or became exposed inside the tent. It says vayal cham avi Knan, and Cham, the father of Knan, which is interesting that they mention Knan here, but here there's something retrospect here. There's something to do with the behavior of the Canaanites in general. Vayal cham avi Chenan et ervat aviv. He saw the nakedness of his father. So people immediately jump forward into Leviticus and say, oh yeah, it's the same thing of seeing each other's nakedness and therefore it's a sexual act. I understand that connection, but it's not necessarily the same thing. It's possible, but we also need to take into consideration the possibility that what we're dealing with here is not necessarily rape. We're dealing here with the possibility of just an abominable way of behaving. Because also remember, the reaction of Shem and Yefet is not yelling at their brother, how dare you? It was going in, showing the exact opposite, respecting their father by walking in backwards and covering him. So the issue here is more to do with the nakedness itself and not with the sexual act. You have to read things sometimes in a much broader perspective. Now, the question is, why is Knaan cursed? So it seems to be you can say Cham was the one being cursed, but because the story has also been written many, many centuries afterwards, and Cham is the father of Knaan, and Knaan, the Canaanites were an enemy of Israel, and as we see, for example, in the stories of Abraham, the sin of the Amorite. The Amorites, which is another way to say Canaanites, because Amuru means the Westerners, and Westerners also include the Canaanites, Phoenicians, the different names you can name these groups by, their behavior was an abomination to other people. Maybe there was a very strong sexual side to what they used to do, or maybe they did, you know, things that seemed regular, nothing to do with the religion or with the occult. It had to do with just their general behavior, their general sexual behavior. So this is more of an accord of why the Canaanites are so corrupt, why are the Canaanites hated, why are Canaanites seen as a cursed group. Same thing you can say about Lot. Why is the story of Lot given to us and it mentions the whole thing with Moab and Ammon? Because Moab and Ammon were both enemies of Israel and both did abominable things towards Israel. They went to war against Israel and so on. So there's a description here of a hatred towards them because of their behavior. So we need to remember there's elements here of retrospect writing as well, because obviously these stories were written, if we say Moses wrote them, or Moses was the final writer of these stories, he would write in things that have to do with his own specific time. And I really don't see any problem with that. So in any case, these are some of the questions that people have about the story of Noach, some of the questions that exist from the academic side of things. Again, as I always say, I present possibilities. I'm not enforcing my opinions on anyone. Hope you enjoyed this one. I want to wish everyone a blessed Shabbat and a Shabbat Shalom.